Teresa, why did you want to go in the first place? What inspired you to reach out to see about volunteering?
I'd actually didn't really know a whole lot about the crisis, and I certainly didn't know about any of the politics. But I think on my Facebook feed one day, there was a picture of a 3-year-old boy dead, face down in the surf, which he's now being referred to as Alan, which is a westernized version of his name. And he had died making the crossing. And I looked at that picture and I thought, why are babies dying? Why are children dying in the middle of an ocean? And so I did a little bit of background research on what was happening and how that could occur. And then I just said to my husband, I think I'm going to go to Greece. And he said, okay.
How long were you there?
I was there for 3 weeks.
Have you been to other international relief efforts such as this one?
I had never done this before. I'd actually never even thought about doing this before. But for whatever reason, that picture and the kind of the background I did just spoke to me. And I'm a retired paramedic. So I knew that I had a skill set that they could possibly use. And I just felt compelled to go. I've never done anything like it. I've never been out of the country except for like a trip to Jamaica for vacation. But I'd never done any kind of international relief. I'd never done any kind of humanitarian relief. I'd never done anything like this before.
Where did you do your paramedic work?
Oh, I've been a paramedic for almost 30 years. So I came from the lower 48 originally, and I've done rural, metro, SWAT, flight. Up here in Alaska, I did flight medicine. I also used to own the paramedic schools here. So I've kind of run the gambit of paramedic stuff. So it's been a long time.
Describe the scene in Lesbos when you first arrived.
Well, I spent a couple of days in Athens before I flew to Lesbos just to kind of center myself. And they are 13 hours different than us. So to make sure that I was on the right, kind of the right time schedule. And then I flew into Lesbos, which is a tiny little airport, much like our village airports. Lesbos is like this idyllic Greek fishing village. And when you think of Greece and you know, stone walls and stone buildings and old castles, and Lesbos kind of embodies all of that. So I flew into Lesbos, and as I'm flying over it, I can see, as we're coming into land, I can see on the shoreline bright orange everywhere, all along the northern shore. And I didn't realize at the time until I found out later, those are life jackets that are being left by refugees. So I get to the airport, I rent a car, and I attempt to find my way to the team house where I'm going to be stationed. And everything's in Greek. I don't speak Greek. But you just kind of figure it out. You stop and ask locals who don't speak English. But if you can pronounce it semi-coherently, they'll point you in the right direction. And I got to the team house, and I had time to unpack. And then my first assignment was at Caracos Lighthouse. And so within a couple of hours, I was on duty, standing at the top of a hill with night vision goggles, scanning the Turkish coastline, looking for heat signatures of people in boats.
What did you hear about how people were making their way to Lesbos, about the smugglers that were helping them get on boats?
Yeah, this is probably the most dangerous part of their journey to that point. And this is only kind of a halfway point for them. So they have to find their way to Turkey from usually Syria, Afghanistan, or Iraq. So they have to get to Turkey somehow. And smugglers help them do that. Think like the coyotes or the smugglers that help people get from Mexico to the United States, kind of that same type of. So they find smugglers to get them to Turkey, or they fly to Turkey if they're financially able to do that. Then they hide out in the woods, and there's no accommodation. So these are illegal camps. So they kind of move around. So sometimes they've been there for up to a week. Inadequate shelter, inadequate food, no sanitation. You know, they're cold and hungry and starving before they even get in the boat. They have to pay $1,500 on average per person to get a spot on the boat. Now, remember that these are desert people. They know nothing about the water. They don't know how to swim. They've never seen an ocean before. When it's their turn, they are forced to then buy a life jacket that usually costs about $150 American or somewhere around in there. These life jackets, we have discovered, are shells that the Turkish smugglers are buying and then stuffing with old clothes, styrofoam, whatever, to make him look puffy. And these people that know nothing about the seas don't realize that these aren't real life jackets. They then tell them, it's your turn on the boat. So they make them assemble these boats, and they're rubber dinghies that were intended for 15 to 20 people, and they put 50 to 60 of them on there. They put the women and children in the middle. They put the men on the outside, and it becomes very apparent very quickly that this is not safe, even for people who don't know anything about the ocean. And if they refuse to get on the boat, they're forced by gunpoint or they're beaten. And there, you will get on this boat. And I heard that story over and over and over again. We didn't want to get on the boat. We realized it wasn't safe. We tried not to get on the boat, but they were forced on the boat. The smugglers do not boat them over. The smugglers point and say, go that way. And they give them just barely enough gas in order to make that. And these, you know, second, third hand engines that oftentimes don't continue running for the duration of the trip. It's only about 6 miles, but I say only. So if you've never been on the water, you're in an overcrowded dinghy, you don't have adequate life jacket on, you know, the sea, even on a calmest day, the sea, when you're in that loaded of a boat, starts to swamp the boat. And someone's driving who has never driven a boat before. They don't know not to hit the waves head on, and it washes over. By the time they get to shore, they're hypothermic, they're wet, they're cold, they're terrified, and often near death or already dead.
How many people were arriving daily?
In the month of January, unfortunately, was the deadliest month for crossing to date. So 368 people died trying to get to Greece from Turkey. In the month of January alone, in the time frame that I was there, 60 of those were below the age of 18. And in the month of January, about 62,000 people came through Greece. 62,000 people in 30 days. And if it was stormy, I was supposed to leave January 20th. January 18th and 19th, big storm, so we didn't have any boats that came. So I ended up extending my stay because I knew that they were backing up in Turkey, waiting for the water to clear to send people over. And the 21st and the 22nd, which was my birthday, we had 15, 20 boats just on our beach alone. And they come all over the shores of Greece because there's no specific landing point. We had them land very close to our team house. One morning we left for work. We came around a bend. There are 50 refugees, wet, cold, shaking, and terrified, walking in the middle of the road because they had landed somewhere and just got out of the boat and started walking. No idea if they were going the right way. No idea what was going to happen. When I stepped out of the car to help them, I don't think I've ever had anybody look at me with that much terror in their face before. They were absolutely terrified of who I was and what I was going to do. And they put the women and children behind them, and all the men surged forward. And I don't speak their language, so the only thing I could do was walk up and just hug them and let them know it's okay, it's okay. And then everybody visibly relaxed, and I happened to have suckers in my pocket, so I passed out suckers to the babies, and then we called buses to come and get them and take them to the camps. So they land haphazardly. And we get the counts because they all eventually have to go to the registration camp. And so that's where those numbers come from.
Beyond hypothermia, what were the things you were treating them for when they got there?
Well, hypothermia was the big deal. They were all cold. They were all wet, especially the children, because they don't have the reserves. They don't have what it takes in order to keep themselves warm, et cetera, et cetera. But we mostly, we saw, cuts and bruises and things like that where Turkish smugglers had beaten them. Or just the trip to get to Turkey was so harrowing. And that's mostly what the deaths come from, near drownings. I had a four-year-old that actually got trampled when the boat landed. They're so desperate to get off the boat. We try to make it as organized as possible. You know, stay on the boat, stay on the boat. You're safe, you're safe. And then we form a corridor and have them come off one at a time and hand us the babies. But they panic sometimes, especially if the sea's a little bit rough. So We had a child who fell in the bottom of the boat and ended up getting stepped on to the point where he stopped breathing. And so we were able to, you know, get him breathing again and call, you know, for him to go to the local Greek hospital. But the biggest, by far, the vast majority of the problems were hypothermia related. They were just so cold and hungry. So that was the other thing, weakness and hunger and dehydration, because they haven't eaten or drank appropriately for days.
How well run was the operation you were assisting? Did you have the supplies you needed?
You know, that's the amazing thing about what's happening over there. It is almost entirely run by NGOs, non-governmental organizations. There is no large presence of Red Cross or UN or the UN or European nation. It's all volunteers. We had clothes, we had food. We always ran out of shoes. We were constantly running out of shoes. But we had, you know, everything that we needed was donated by somebody. And all of these non-government organizations were run by volunteers. So there's no collective. I'd never seen anything like it. And until I got to Greece, I didn't know what an NGO was. In the United States, when we have huge major disasters, we have a governmental agency in whatever form that takes, kind of eventually show up and take order and order food and make sure that there's, that's not happening. So it was either feast or famine, quite frankly. We were good on medical supplies because all of us that came over medical, we bring stuff. But we were constantly running short on men's shoes and dry clothes, because the minute they get off the boat, we get them out of wet clothes and we get them in dry clothes and we give them something to eat and something to drink. And so the supplies weren't bad, but like I said, it was feast or famine. There were times that we didn't have what we needed, and there were times we had more than we needed. So
was there any assistance at all from either from Greece government officials or from other countries that went beyond the NGOs that were there?
Not that I saw. And I'm not going to pretend to understand all the politics that are going on over there. But my personal experience was the only time that we saw Greek or Turkish officials was in the water. So between Greece and Turkey, there is Turkish waters. Then there's a strip of international, and then then it becomes Greek water, and you would see the Turkish Coast Guard and you would see the Greek Coast Guard in their perspective waters, and nobody in the middle. And some days we heard from refugees that the Greek Coast Guard actually would cut their fuel lines in attempt to get them to turn back to go to Greece. You know, I didn't see a large presence. Just before I left, an organization called Frontex, which is an international police agency, showed up. I'm not sure what they were there for, and I'm not sure what their actual mission was. I think it was to kind of restore some order. There's been a lot of pressure, apparently, on stopping the influx of the refugees and stopping them coming through Greece. So I didn't see anybody. I saw NGOs. I saw volunteers from all over the world, on the beaches, in the camps, in the medical clinics, you know, constantly asking for donations. But I saw no governmental organization in charge of any of it.
You wrote to me that you tried to listen to the stories of the refugees who came to Lesbos. Tell us what you heard from them.
Yeah, I thought it was important for them to be able to tell their stories, and they seemed to feel that it was very important to tell their stories because they left everything behind. And I met doctors, lawyers, graphic artists, teachers from all walks of life. They live the lives that we're living right now, or they did. And this huge warring faction that's going on has made them have to leave their country. Nobody puts a child in a boat and risks them dying if it's not a better option than what they left behind. And so I thought that it was important that they have a voice and that somebody listen to their story. And a lot of them are afraid that they're never going to complete the journey, that they're not going to make it to wherever it is that's safe for them. So they felt compelled. I heard heartbreaking stories. The man whose boat capsized and he lost all six of his children and his wife. They're all gone. He was the only survivor. He only came to protect them. And so his sense of guilt of not being able to protect them, putting them in the boat, you know, hoping that they would make it and they didn't. You know, the woman who, you know, lost her child for the same reason. The boat went down and then the child didn't survive and was never found. He was washed to sea. The 17-year-old that was sent over by himself because they had come and taken his father and then they took his brothers one by one. And he doesn't know where they are and he doesn't know what happened to them. But his mother said to him, "I can't wait for them to come take you." And she could only afford to send him. So she put him on a boat and sent him, and she may never see him again. He may never see her again. But, you know, she wanted him to have whatever was on the other side because it was better than where they were.
Were most of them from Syria?
Most of them are from Syria, and there are some from Afghanistan, there are some from Iraq, but the vast majority are from Syria because Syria has been decimated, absolutely decimated. So they really, you know, have no place to go. They don't have home. They can't stay home because there is no home.
Are you staying in touch with folks that are still there in Lesbos? And if so, what do you know about what's happening now?
I actually am. My Facebook feed is full of languages I don't speak. And thank goodness for Facebook Translate. It has been an amazing eye-opening journey for me, just of other cultures and other you know, worlds, basically. And so I am still in touch with people that are on the ground in Lesbos. Some of my team is still there. I was with Disaster Medics, which is actually based in Ireland. And some of those teams are still there. Friendships that I've made, you know, the nurse that I worked with is back in Lebanon. She lives in Lebanon. But my understanding, it's very fluid. It changes almost daily. My understanding of what's happening now is in response to pressure of stop these refugees from coming, is that the Coast Guard is now picking people up out of the water in the middle between Greece and Turkey and then bringing them to port. I like that better. If it keeps people from drowning in the middle of the ocean, then I'm okay with that. I'm not sure what's happening to them from there. And the humanitarian, like the heart in me says, I hope they're treating them well. Like, I hope when they get on the boat that they've got dry clothes and they've got food and you know, that they get them to the camp and they're nice to them, you know? So from what I'm understanding, though, the actual boats on the beaches have slowed down considerably because the Coast Guard is picking them up. However, this happened one time before, but it only lasted about 10 days, and then it stopped happening. And they're not going to quit coming. They're not going to quit coming. Everything behind them is on fire. And so when everything behind you is on fire, you run from the fire. And if that means you get in the water and you go to where there's no fire or the fires are smaller, then you're going to go.
As you said earlier, you haven't done international humanitarian work before. You're a trained paramedic, so
yes.
Of course you've dealt with trauma, but
yes.
Not on a scale as this situation in Lesbos. How has this affected you personally?
Well, I haven't been home a week yet, so tomorrow will be, today's Wednesday, right? Yeah, I'm still not quite there. Tomorrow will be 7 days that I've been home. And I'm still not quite here yet. You know, I'm still following all the feeds on what's going on in Lesbos. I'm still texting my teammates that are there saying, what's happening? Is this really true? Did a boat go down? You know, that kind of thing. And I find little things cropping up, like the boots I wore in Lesbos, they're covered in the dirt of Greece. I started to do laundry the other day and I pulled a pair of pants out and both the knees are coated in mud. And that's where I was on my knees on the beach. And I had unzipped my coat and wrapped like a 3-year-old in my coat because he was shivering. And I didn't know if it was from fear or cold or both, but I just held him in my coat until we could find his parents on the boat. He had gotten separated. My coat still smells like the lighthouse where you did overnight shifts. It was built in 1800s and the chimney is too short. So the fireplace smoke comes back in the room constantly, and it smells like that. And I find myself hesitating to wash it because, you know, it just sort of reminds me. But, you know, standing in the line at the grocery store the other day, and the lady in front of me complaining because the line was too long and it was taking too long for the line. And I thought to myself, you know, a week ago, I was standing at the Syrian registration line in the Moria camp where there were 3,000 people waiting to get registered. And it was raining and it was cold and they were hungry and the children were crying and they were soaking wet and desperate. I'm like, I can wait in this line for 10 minutes. I'm okay with that, you know? So you get like little flashes. And then there's always part of you that wants to go back. Like, you know, now I've got experience because people, they need people, and then they need people with experience. You know, the longer you can stay, the better. A lot of people can't devote that kind of time. You know, 3 weeks was a stretch for me. I have kids at home and my husband is amazing, but it was still kind of a stretch, you know. So I thought, well, I can offer even more now. And you just have to kind of take a deep breath and realize they were coming long before you. They're going to keep coming long after you. And so, you know, what I did when I was there made a difference. And I have to let that be okay and let that be enough and go on from there.
What do you think or want the U.S. to do? And what should citizens do? What should people do to help?
You know, I don't really have a good answer for that. I've heard a lot of things about the Syrians coming over and how they should stay and fight for their country. And, you know, we don't, especially in America, it's very, we don't want you here. And I got to tell you, I don't know what the answer is, but I know that when I'm standing on the beaches of Greece and I help a man off the boat who speaks English because he used to teach English, and I say to him, welcome, and he looked at me puzzled and he said, where am I? And I said, you're in Greece. And he said, they speak English here? And I said, no, I'm American. And he got this startled look on his face and he took a step backwards and he said, American? Why are you here? And I said, I'm here to help you. And he said, but you're afraid of me. And I said, I'm not afraid of you. I'm not afraid of you. And he said, your government is. And I said, I think they probably are, and I'm sorry. But I'm not afraid of you. So today I'm here to help you. And he threw himself in my arms and started to cry and said, thank you, Mrs. Thank you. Thank you. You don't need to be afraid of me. You don't need to be afraid of me. I have 17-year-old boys saying to me, you're from Alaska? Alaska is very, very big. I could live in Alaska. I could live there. I could come and help. I'll be good. That's what he said to me. I'll be good. If you let me come to Alaska, I'll be good. I don't know what to say to that. What do I say? This child is pleading with me. I want to come to America. How come I can't come to America? I don't know. Kasim, I don't know why you can't come to America. I don't know what the answer is. I struggle with that.
Well, thank you so much for coming in with this story, and thank you for going to do the help that you did do.
Well, thank you so much for having me and allowing me to tell my story, and if nothing more than to just bring awareness. I never once felt afraid. I never once felt afraid. I felt nothing but gratitude from these people. So I appreciate being here. I appreciate being able to tell the story. I appreciate being able to just spread the awareness and open people's eyes. And regardless of what your politics are, on the shores of Lesvos, Greece, you know, you have no choice of what boundary or what border you were born behind. None of us have that choice. And I understand there are political ramifications. I understand that there is some fear. I understand that there's a lot of misunderstanding, but I don't think that we should lay our humanitarianism aside and stop becoming people who care and start becoming people who are afraid. I don't want to be afraid. I want to be someone who cares. That's what I want to be in the forefront, and that's what I want my daughters to see. I don't know these people. I don't speak their language. I don't know their religion at all. I didn't even know really where in the world they came from until I started doing a little research. But I knew they were dying in the ocean. And so I went. And I want my daughters to see you know, instead of saying somebody should do something about that, recognize that you are somebody and go do something, anything.
Thank you so much, Teresa.
You're welcome.